time they had sex. George W. Bush never signed on entirely to the anti-condom campaign being waged by many within his administration, and the United States continued to donate more condoms than any other country, with mild increases over the years. Ironically, it was the Clinton administration, and a stingy Republican Congress at the time, that gutted American donations of condoms. From 800 million condoms donated annually during the George H.W. Bush administration, to a low of about 190 million in 1999. The George W. Bush administration donated more than 400 million condoms a year during its second term. The Bush administration focused its AIDS prevention campaign on abstinence-only programs. There is some evidence that abstinence education can be helpful when paired with a discussion of condoms, contraception, and reproductive health. But the Bush program went beyond underwriting abstinence education. It insisted on abstinence only for young people, meaning no discussion of condoms in schools, although the Bush AIDS program did distribute condoms readily to high-risk groups, such as prostitutes and truck drivers in Africa. Indeed, one-third of AIDS prevention spending was funneled by law to abstinence-only education. One American-sponsored abstinence-only approach consists of handing out heart-shaped lollipops inscribed with the message, "Don't be a sucker. Save sex for marriage." Then the session leader invites girls to suck on the lollipops and explains, "Your body is a wrapped lollipop. When you have sex with a man, he unwraps your lollipop and sucks on it. It may feel great at the time, but unfortunately, when he's done with you, all you have left for your next partner is a poorly wrapped, saliva-fouled sucker." Studies on the impact of abstinence-only programs aren't conclusive and seem to depend to some extent on the ideology of those conducting the study. But on balance, the evidence suggests that they slightly delay the debut of sexual activity. Once it has been initiated, however, the kids are less likely to use contraception. The studies suggest that the result is more pregnancies, more abortions, more sexually transmitted diseases, and more HIV. Advocacy groups like the International Women's Health Coalition fought heroically for evidence-based policies on sexual health. And Congresswoman Carolyn Maloney battled tenaciously for UNFPA programs, but the White House wasn't listening. Finally, President Obama, in his first week in office, announced that he would restore full funding to family planning groups and to UNFPA. One of the premises of the abstinence-only campaign had been that Africa's AIDS problem was a consequence of promiscuity, but that may not have been true, particularly for African women. Emily Oster, an economist at the University of Chicago, notes that about 0.8% of American adults are infected with HIV, compared to 6% of adults in sub-Saharan Africa. When she examined the data, she couldn't find any indication that Africans are more promiscuous. In fact, Americans and Africans report a similar number of sexual partners, although some experts believe that in Africa, they are more likely to be concurrent rather than consecutive. The biggest difference, Oster found, was that transmission rates are much higher in Africa than in America. For any given unprotected sexual relationship with an infected person, Africans are 4 or 5 times more likely to get HIV themselves. That higher rate can be explained in part because Americans get treated for genital sores. Africans often don't. At any one time, 11% of Africans have untreated bacterial genital infections, and these sores allow for easy transmission of the virus. Public health experts widely acknowledge that one of the most cost-effective ways to treat HIV is to provide free checkups and treatment for such STDs. Oster notes that when AIDS prevention resources are devoted to treating STDs, the cost per year per life saved from AIDS is only about $3.50. In any case, for women, the lethal risk factor is often not promiscuity, but marriage. Routinely, in Africa and Asia, women stay safe until they marry, and then they contract AIDS from their husbands. In Cambodia, a 27-year-old former prostitute told us of her struggles with AIDS, and we assumed that she had caught the virus in the brothel. "Oh no," she said. "I got AIDS later, from my husband. In the brothel, I always use condoms. But when I was married, I didn't use a condom. A woman with a husband is in much more danger than a girl in a brothel." That's an exaggeration, but it underscores a central reality. AIDS is often a disease of gender inequality. Particularly in Southern Africa, young women frequently don't have the power to say no to unprotected sex. Teenage girls, for example, often become the baubles of middle-aged men, and so HIV spreads relentlessly. As Stephen Lewis, the former UN ambassador for AIDS, puts it, "Gender inequality is driving the pandemic." One test of a program should be how it handles the challenge of a 14-year-old girl like Tabang, who lives in the village of Kwamalanga in the northeastern part of South Africa. Tall, flirtatious, and liberal with makeup, Tabang is a rebellious adolescent who would be a challenge for any program. Tabang's father, an electrician, died after a protracted battle against AIDS that consumed the family's savings. Tabang's mother, Gertrude Tobela, tested positive, apparently after getting the disease from her husband, and then infected her youngest child, Victor, during childbirth. Gertrude had been the first in her family to go to high school and college, and the family had enjoyed a middle-class standard of living. But soon, Gertrude was too sick to work, and the family had to survive on $22.50 a month government payments. The atmosphere in the shack in which they lived was despairing. Tabang is smart and talented, and like any teenager, she yearned for fun and warmth and love. She dreaded the misery of the shack, so she began to hang out in town. She had her hair done fashionably and wore sexy clothes, seeking the diversions of boys to escape the claustrophobia of her home. She also wanted more independence, yearned to be a grown-up, and resented her mother's efforts to rein her in. Tabang also has the misfortune of being strikingly attractive, so men flattered her with their attentions. In South Africa, successful middle-aged men often keep young teenage girls as mistresses, and many teenagers see such sugar daddies as a ladder to a better life. When Tabang began flirting with men, Gertrude screamed at her and beat her. Tabang was the only member of the family who didn't have AIDS, and Gertrude was aghast at the possibility that Tabang would contract the virus as well. But Gertrude's beatings infuriated Tabang, confirmed the girl's suspicions that her mother hated her, and prompted her to run away. Tabang also seemed to feel embarrassed by her AIDS-ridden mother, weak and frail and poor, and all their fighting left Gertrude even more exhausted and depressed. Gertrude spoke in a composed way about her own imminent death and Victor's, but she broke down completely when she spoke of Tabang. "My daughter left me because she wants liberty," Gertrude said, sobbing. "She is so sexually active, and she stays in bars and rental rooms." Gertrude looked upon Tabang's fondness for makeup and tight clothes with horror, and couldn't bear the thought that the cycle of AIDS would be repeated in the next generation. For her part, Tabang insisted that while her friends slept with men for cash or gifts, she herself did not. "I'm a virgin, whatever my mother says," Tabang said, and she began to cry as well. "She never believes me. She just yells at me." "Your mother loves you," Nick told her. "The only reason she scolds you is that she loves you and cares what happens to you." "She doesn't love me," Tabang replied fiercely, tears trickling down her cheeks as she stood outside her home 15 feet away from her mother, who was also crying. "If she did, she would talk to me instead of beating me. She wouldn't say these things about me. She would accept my friends." There's no question that the local schools should encourage abstinence for girls like Tabang. But those programs shouldn't stop there. They should explain that condoms can dramatically reduce the risk of HIV transmission, and they should demonstrate how to use condoms properly. Governments should encourage male circumcision, which reduces HIV risk significantly, and should encourage free screening and treatment for sexually transmitted diseases. Testing for HIV should become routine, requiring people to opt out instead of to opt in. That way, nearly all adults would know their AIDS status, which is crucial because it's impossible to contain an epidemic when people do not know whether or not they have been infected. That kind of comprehensive approach to prevention would be most effective in reducing the risks to a girl like Tabang. And these prevention methods are much cheaper than treating an AIDS patient for years. Most of the studies on preventing AIDS aren't rigorous, but scholars at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Poverty Action Lab, which does some of the finest research on development anywhere, have examined four different strategies against AIDS in careful trials in Africa. Each strategy was tried in randomly chosen areas, and the results were compared to results in control areas. Success was measured by pregnancies averted, compared to the control areas, since they presumably reflected the amount of unprotected sex that could also transmit AIDS. One strategy was to train elementary school teachers in AIDS education. That cost only $2 per student, but had no impact on reducing pregnancies. A second approach was to encourage student debates and essays on condoms and AIDS. That cost only $1 per student, but was not shown to reduce pregnancies. A third approach was to provide students with free uniforms to encourage them to stay in school longer. That cost about $12 per student and did reduce pregnancies. Using their comparisons with the control areas, the researchers calculated that the cost was $750 per pregnancy averted. The fourth, and by far the most effective approach, was also the simplest: a warning of the perils of sugar daddies. School children were shown a brief video of the dangers of teenage girls going out with older men, and then were informed that older men have much higher HIV infection rates than boys. Few students had been aware of that crucial fact. The warning didn't reduce girls' sexual activity, but they did end up sleeping with boyfriends their own age rather than with older men. The boys were more likely to use condoms, apparently because they were shaken by learning from the school presentation that teenage girls were much more likely than teenage boys to have HIV. This simple program was a huge success. It cost less than $1 per student, and a pregnancy could be averted for only $91. It's also a reminder of the need for relentless empiricism in developing policies. Conservatives who have presumed that the key to preventing AIDS is abstinence-only education, and liberals who have focused on distribution of condoms, should both note that the intervention that has tested most cost-effective in Africa is neither. Religious conservatives have fought against condom distribution and battled funding for UNFPA. But they have also saved lives in vast numbers by underwriting and operating clinics in some of the neediest parts of Africa and Asia. When you travel in the poorest countries in Africa, you repeatedly find diplomats, UN staff, and aid organizations in the capitals or big cities. And then you go to the remote villages and towns where Western help is most needed, and aid workers are suddenly scarce. Doctors Without Borders works heroically in remote areas, and so do some other secular groups. But the people you almost inevitably encounter are the missionary doctors and church-sponsored aid workers. Nick's plane once crashed when he was flying into Central Congo, so he decided to drive out. In nearly a week of traversing a vast stretch of this war-torn country, the only foreign presence he encountered was two Catholic missions. The priest in one had just died of malaria, but the other mission was run by an Italian priest who distributed food and clothing and tried to keep a clinic going in the middle of a civil war. Likewise, Catholic Relief Services fights poverty all over the world, not least by supporting Sunitha's shelter for former prostitutes in India. All told, some 25% of AIDS care worldwide is provided by church-related groups. In most of Africa, these are the cornerstone of the health system, Dr. Helene Gale, the head of care, said of the Catholic-run clinics. In some countries, they serve more people than the government health system. Moreover, the Catholic Church as a whole has always been much more sympathetic to condoms than the Vatican has been. Local priests and nuns often ignore Rome and quietly do what they can to save parishioners. In Sonsonate, in the poor southwestern part of El Salvador, the Catholic hospital advises women about IUDs and the pill and urges them to use condoms to protect themselves from AIDS. "The bishop is in San Salvador and never comes here," explained Dr. Martha Alicia de Regalada. "So we never get in trouble." Nor was she worried that she would get into trouble for being quoted speaking so frankly. Missionaries have been running indispensable health and education networks in some of the poorest countries for decades, and it would be enormously beneficial to bring their schools and clinics into a global movement to empower women and girls. Those missionaries have invaluable on-the-ground experience. Aid workers and diplomats come and go, but missionaries burrow into a society, learn the local language, send their children to local schools, sometimes stay for life. True, some missionaries are hypocritical or sanctimonious, just like any group of people. But many others are like Harper McConnell at the hospital in Congo, struggling to act on a gospel of social justice as well as individual morality. If there is to be a successful movement on behalf of women in poor countries, it will have to bridge the God gulf. Secular bleeding hearts and religious bleeding hearts will have to forge a common cause. That's what happened 2 centuries ago in the abolitionist movement, when liberal deists and conservative evangelicals joined forces to overthrow slavery. And it's the only way to muster the political will to get now invisible women onto the international agenda. It is particularly crucial to incorporate Pentecostalism into a movement for women's rights around the globe, because it is gaining ground more quickly than any other faith, especially in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. The church with the largest Sunday attendance in all of Europe is now a Pentecostal megachurch in Kiev, Ukraine, founded in 1994 by a charismatic Nigerian, Sunday Adelaja. 1 person in 10 is now a Pentecostal, according to the highest estimates. Those estimates may be exaggerated several fold, but there is no doubt about Pentecostalism's spread throughout poor countries. One reason for that is the suggestion made by some of its churches that God will reward adherents with riches in this life. Some also teach variations of faith healing, or claim that Jesus will protect its followers from AIDS. We thus regard the Pentecostal boom with some suspicion, but without a doubt, it also has a positive impact on the role of women. Pentecostal churches typically encourage all members of the congregation to speak up and preach during the service. So for the first time, many ordinary women find themselves exercising leadership and declaring their positions on moral and religious matters. On Sundays, women come together and exchange advice on how to apply community pressure to bring wayward husbands back into line. Just as important, Pentecostalism and other conservative evangelical denominations discourage drinking and adultery, and these are both practices that have caused tremendous hardship to African women in particular. Until the late 1990s, conservative Christians were mostly a force for isolationism, worrying, as Jesse Helms put it, that foreign aid is money down a rat hole. But under the influence of Franklin Graham, Billy Graham's son, now head of the Samaritan's Purse Aid Organization, and Senator Sam Brownback and many others, evangelicals and other conservative Christians have come to focus on issues like AIDS, sex trafficking, and poverty. Now, the National Association of Evangelicals is an important force for humanitarian causes and foreign aid. It's because of encouragement from evangelicals, including Michael Gerson, a former White House chief speechwriter, that George W. Bush sponsored his presidential initiative to fight AIDS, the best single thing he ever did, arguably saving more than 9 million lives. Michael Horowitz, an agitator for humanitarian causes based at the Hudson Institute in Washington, has rallied religious conservatives to back an initiative to repair obstetric fistulas. These days, bleeding heart evangelicals are out in front alongside bleeding heart liberals in fighting for aid money to tackle these problems, as well as malaria. That's a landmark change from a decade or two ago. Poverty and disease just weren't on my agenda, Rick Warren, pastor of the Saddleback megachurch in California and author of The Purpose-Driven Life, told us. I missed the AIDS thing. I had no idea what the big deal was. Then in 2003, Warren went to South Africa to train pastors and found a small congregation in a tent caring for 25 AIDS orphans. I realized that they were doing more for the poor than my entire megachurch, he said with cheerful exaggeration. It was like a knife in the heart. Since then, Warren has galvanized his church to fight poverty and injustice in 68 countries around the world. More than 7,500 members of the church have paid their own way to volunteer in poor countries, and once they see the poverty up close, they want to do more. Liberals could emulate the willingness of many evangelicals to tithe, to donate 10% of their incomes each year to charity. The Index of Global Philanthropy calculates that U.S. religious organizations give $5.4 billion annually to developing countries, more than twice as much as is given by U.S. foundations. Arthur Brooks, an economist, has found that the one-third of Americans who attend worship services at least once a week are inarguably more charitable in every measurable way than the two-thirds who are less religious. Not only do they donate more, he says, but they are also more likely to volunteer their time for charities. Brooks does find, however, that while liberals are less generous with their own money, they are more likely to favor government funding of humanitarian causes. Both groups might work harder to ensure that their charitable contributions truly go to the needy. Conservative Christians contribute very generously to humanitarian causes, but a significant share of that money goes to build magnificent churches. Likewise, liberal contributions often go to elite universities or symphonies. These may be good causes, but they are not humanitarian. It would be good to see liberals and conservatives alike expand their range of giving so that more goes to help the truly needy. It would also be useful if there were better mechanisms for people to donate time. The Peace Corps is a valuable program, but it requires an intimidating commitment of 27 months, and the schedule does not easily accommodate those who are trying to delay graduate school. Teach for America has generated enormous interest among public service-minded young people, but it is a domestic program. We need funding for Teach the World, an international version of Teach for America, to send young people abroad for a year, a term that would then be renewable. That would offer an important new channel of foreign assistance to support girls' education in poor countries, and it would also offer young Americans a potentially life-changing encounter with the developing world. Jane Roberts and her 34 million friends. When George W. Bush announced early in his first administration that the United States would withhold all $34 million that had been allocated for the UNFPA, many people grumbled about it. But Jane Roberts, a retired French teacher in Redlands, California, grumbled herself into starting a movement. It began with a letter to the editor of her local paper, the San Bernardino Sun. A week has passed since the Bush administration decided to deny the $34 million voted by Congress for the United Nations Population Fund. Ho-hum, this is vacation time. Columnists have written about it, and newspapers have printed editorials of lament. Ho-hum. More women die in childbirth in a few days than terrorism kills people in a year. Ho-hum. Some little girl is having her genitals cut with a cactus needle. Ho-hum, that's just a cultural thing. As an exercise in outraged democracy, would 34 million of my fellow citizens please join me in sending $1 each to the U.S. Committee for UNFPA? That would right a terrible wrong and drown out the ho-hums. Jane is blue-eyed with short blonde hair and carries a hint of the 60s in her dress and manner, a taste for African necklaces and simple clothing like black loafers. She was now on a mission. Jane contacted groups like the Sierra Club and League of Women Voters. After she saw a mention in the newspaper about the National Council of Women's Organizations, she barraged the council with pestering phone calls and emails. A week later, its board endorsed her effort. At the same time, a grandmother in New Mexico named Lois Abraham was thinking along the same lines as Jane. She had read a column Nick had written from Khartoum, Sudan, about a teenage girl with an obstetric fistula, noting that the administration was now crippling one of the few organizations helping such girls. Lois angrily drafted a chain letter about the UNFPA and the funding cutoff. It ended, "If 34 million American women send $1 each to the UN Population Fund, we can help the fund continue its invaluable work and at the same time confirm that providing family planning and reproductive health services to women who would otherwise have none is a humanitarian issue, not a political one. Please, now, put a dollar wrapped in a plain sheet of paper in an envelope marked 34 million friends, then mail it today. Even more important, send this letter on to at least 10 friends. More would be better, who may join in this message." Lois had cold-called the UNFPA and told an official she was sending out the email. UNFPA didn't have much of a public image and rarely received contributions. Some in UNFPA were doubtful about such a grassroots effort, recalled Sterling Scruggs, a former senior official in the agency. They thought it would last a few weeks and that the two women would tire and it would end quickly. That is, until bags of mail started piling up at UNFPA's mailroom. The deluge of dollar bills triggered by Lois and Jane soon caused a problem. UNFPA had pledged that all the money would go to programs, but somebody had to handle all the mail. At first, staff members from throughout devoted their lunch hours to opening envelopes. Then, supporters of the U.S. Committee for UNFPA volunteered their help. Finally, the UN Foundation gave grants to hire staff to handle the mail. Most of the money consisted of $1 bills from women, and some men, all across the country. Some sent larger amounts. "This $5 is in honor of the women in my life, my mother, my wife, my two daughters, and my granddaughter," one man wrote. UNFPA informed Lois and Jane about each other, and they joined forces, formalizing their campaign as 34 Million Friends of UNFPA. www.34millionfriends.org. They began going on speaking tours, and the movement gained steam. People around the country were exasperated by the social conservatives' campaigns against reproductive health. The defunding of UNFPA, the denunciations of condoms and comprehensive sex education, the attempts to cut off support for family planning by aid groups like Marie Stopes International. And they were eager to do something concrete to help. Sending in a dollar bill wasn't a panacea, but it was very easy to do. "No one can say, 'I can't give a dollar,'" Jane noted. "We're even getting donations from college students and high school students. You can take a stand for the women of the world for just the price of a soda." Both Ellen Goodman and Molly Ivins wrote columns praising Jane and Lois and their work, and donations reached 2,000 a day. Jane traveled with UNFPA to Mali and Senegal, her first visit to Africa, and began speaking and campaigning nonstop. "From that time on, I have given my life to this," she told Cheryl. "I'm going to follow this to the ends of the earth to further this cause. 40 women every minute seek unsafe abortions. To me, this is just a crime against humanity." After President Obama announced in January 2009 that he would restore funding for UNFPA, the question arose, is 34 million friends still necessary? Should it fade away? But by then, the group started by two indignant women had raised a total of $4 million, and they saw vast needs remaining. So they decided to continue their work as a supplement to American government funding of UNFPA. There is a huge unmet demand for family planning in the world today, Jane said. There is a huge need for fistula prevention and treatment. With population pressures and environmental pressures and economic pressures in much of the world, women will bear the brunt of gender-based violence even more than now. So for me, 34 Million Friends is my work. It is my passion. I don't think any cause is greater for the long term for people, the planet, and peace. So for me, on we go. Chapter 9. Is Islam misogynistic? A majority of the dwellers of hell will be women, who curse too much and are ungrateful to their spouses. Muhammad Imran, Ideal Woman in Islam. On Nick's first trip to Afghanistan, he employed an interpreter who had studied English in university. He was a very brave man and seemed very modern until one particular discussion. My mother has never been to a doctor, the interpreter said, and she never will go. Why not? Nick asked. There are no female doctors here now, and I cannot allow her to go to a male doctor. That would be against Islam. And since my father died, I'm in charge of her. She cannot leave the house without my permission. But what if your mother were dying, and the only way to save her would be to take her to a doctor? That would be a terrible thing, the interpreter said gravely. I would mourn my mother. A politically incorrect point must be noted here. Of the countries where women are held back and subjected to systematic abuses, such as honor killings and genital cutting, a very large proportion are predominantly Muslim. Most Muslims worldwide don't believe in such practices, and some Christians do. But the fact remains that the countries where girls are cut, killed for honor, or kept out of school or the workplace typically have large Muslim populations. Hinduism has similar problems, not to mention vicious burnings of brides by their new families, but Hindu women in India are more autonomous and more likely to be educated than their Muslim women neighbors. To look at one broad gauge of well-being, of 128 countries rated by the World Economic Forum according to the status of women, 10 of the bottom 12 were majority Muslim. Yemen was in last place. We tend to think of Latin America, with its legacy of machismo, as a man's world. But Mexico and other Latin countries actually do pretty well in educating girls and keeping them alive. Most Latin nations have populations that are majority female. Maternity hospitals, even in poor neighborhoods of South American cities, such as Bogota and Quito, provide free prenatal care and delivery, because saving women's lives is considered by society to be a priority. In contrast, opinion polls underscore that Muslims in some countries just don't believe in equality. Only 25% of Egyptians believe that a woman should have the right to become president. More than 34% of Moroccans approve of polygamy. Some 54% of Afghan women say that women should wear the burqa outside the house. Conservative Muslims often side with the top religious authority in Saudi Arabia, Grand Mufti Sheikh Abdulaziz, who declared in 2004, "Allowing women to mix with men is the root of every evil and catastrophe." Muslims sometimes note that such conservative attitudes have little to do with the Quran and arise from culture more than religion. That's true. In these places, even religious minorities and irreligious people are often deeply repressive toward women. In Pakistan, we met a young woman from the Christian minority who insisted on choosing her own husband. Infuriated at this breach of family honor, Her brothers bickered over whether they should kill her or just sell her to a brothel. While they argued, she escaped. After the Taliban was ousted in Afghanistan, banditry spread, and Amnesty International quoted an aid worker as saying, "During the Taliban era, if a woman went to market and showed an inch of flesh, she would have been flogged. Now, she's raped." In short, we often blame a region's religion when the oppression may instead be rooted in its culture. Yet that acknowledged, it's also true that one reason religion is blamed is that it is often cited by the oppressors. In the Muslim world, for example, misogynists routinely quote Muhammad to justify themselves. So, let's face the question squarely. Is Islam misogynistic? One answer is historical, and it is no. When Muhammad introduced Islam in the 7th century, it was a step forward for women. Islamic law banned the previously common practice of female infanticide, and it limited polygamy to 4 wives who were supposed to be treated equally. Muslim women routinely owned property, with rights protected by the law, while women in European countries often did not have the equivalent property rights. All in all, Muhammad comes across in the Quran and the traditions associated with him as much more respectful of women than early Christian leaders. After all, the Apostle Paul wanted women to keep silent in church, and the early Christian leader Tertullian denounced women as the gateway of the devil. Yet over the centuries, Christianity has mostly moved beyond that. In contrast, conservative Islam has barely budged. It is still frozen in the worldview of 7th century Arabia, amid attitudes that were progressive for the time, but now are a millennium out of date. When a girl's junior high school caught fire in Saudi Arabia in 2002, the religious police allegedly forced teenage girls back into the burning building rather than allow them to escape without head coverings and long black cloaks. 14 girls were reportedly burned to death. The Quran explicitly endorses some gender discrimination. A woman's testimony counts only half as much as a man's, and a daughter inherits only half as much as a son. When these kinds of passages arise in the Bible, Christians and Jews mostly shrug them off. It has been much harder for pious Muslims to ignore unpleasant and antiquated passages in the Quran, because it is believed to be not just divinely inspired, but literally the word of God. Still, many modern-minded Muslims are pushing for greater gender equality. Amina Wadud, an Islamic scholar in the United States, has written a systematic reinterpretation of chauvinist provisions in the Quran. For example, verse 434 refers to wives and is usually translated roughly like this: "As for those from whom ye fear rebellion, admonish them and banish them to beds apart and beat them." Feminist scholars like Wadud cite a barrage of reasons to argue that this is a mistranslation. For example, the word translated above as beat can have many other meanings, including to have sex with someone. Thus, one new translation presents that same passage this way: "As for women you feel are averse, talk to them persuasively. Then leave them alone in bed, without molesting them, and go to bed with them when they are willing." The Islamic feminists, as these scholars are known, argue that it is absurd for Saudi Arabia to bar women from driving because Muhammad allowed his wives to drive camels. They say that the stipulation that 2 female witnesses equal 1 male witness applied only to financial cases, because women at the time were less familiar with finance. That situation is now obsolete, they say. And so is that provision. The feminist exegesis argues that if the Quran originally was progressive, then it should not be allowed to become an apologia for backwardness. A useful analogy is slavery. Islam provided the position of slaves compared to their status in pre-Islamic societies, and the Quran encourages the freeing of slaves as a meritorious act. At the same time, Muhammad himself had many slaves, and Islamic law unmistakably accepts slavery. Indeed, Saudi Arabia abolished slavery only in 1962, and Mauritania in 1981. In the end, despite these deep cultural ties, the Islamic world has entirely renounced slavery. If the Quran can be read differently today because of changing attitudes towards slaves, then why not emancipate women as well? Muhammad himself was progressive on gender issues, but some early successors, such as the Caliph Omar, were unmitigated chauvinists. One reason for their hostility to strong women may have been personality clashes with the Prophet's youngest wife, Aisha, the Islamic world's first feminist. Aisha was the only one of Muhammad's wives who was a virgin upon marriage to him, and she grew to be a strong-willed woman with whom he spent a great deal of time. Aisha knew firsthand the perils of a society that treated a woman as a fragile chalice of honor, for she herself was once accused of adultery. While traveling across the desert in a caravan, she lost a necklace and went to look for it, and then was left behind by the caravan. A man named Safwan found Aisha and rescued her. But since they had been together without a chaperone, they were accused of having an affair. Muhammad sided with her. That's when he had the revelation about needing 4 witnesses to attest to adultery before punishment could be applied, and ordered that the accusers be flogged with 40 lashes. After Muhammad died in Aisha's arms, according to Sunni doctrine, which is disputed by Shiites, she took on an active and public role, in a way that annoyed many men. Aisha vigorously contested views of Islam that were hostile to women, and she recorded 2,210 hadith, or recollections of Muhammad used in Islam to supplement and clarify Quranic teachings. Ultimately, Aisha even led an armed rebellion against a longtime adversary, Ali, after he became caliph. That insurrection is called the Battle of the Camel, because Aisha commanded her troops by riding among them on a camel. Ali crushed the rebellion, and then for centuries, Islamic scholars discounted Aisha's importance and rejected her feminist interpretations. All but 174 of her hadith were discarded. Yet in recent decades, some Islamic feminists, such as Fatima Mernissi, a Moroccan, have dusted off Aisha's work to provide a powerful voice for Muslim women. There is, for example, a well-known statement attributed to Muhammad, stipulating that a man's prayers are ineffective if a woman, dog, or donkey passes in front of the believer. As Mernissi notes, Aisha ridiculed that as nonsense. "You compare us now to donkeys and dogs? In the name of God, I have seen the Prophet saying his prayers while I was there." Likewise, Aisha denied various suggestions that her husband considered menstruating women to be unclean. Another dispute about the Quran concerns the idyllic black-eyed virgins who supposedly will attend to man in the Islamic afterlife. These are the Huri, and some Islamic theologians have been quite specific in describing them. A 9th-century scholar, Al-Tirmidhi, recounted that Huri are gorgeous young women with white skin, who never menstruate, urinate, or defecate. He added that they have large breasts that are not inclined to dangle. Suicide bombers have often written about their expectations of being rewarded by the Huri, and Muhammad Atta reassured his fellow hijackers on the eve of 9/11, "The Huri are calling you." The bombers may be in for a surprise. The Arabic language was born as a written language only with the Quran, and so many of its words are puzzling. Scholars are beginning to examine early copies of the Quran with academic rigor, and some argue that a number of these puzzling words may actually have been Syriac or Aramaic. A scholar who uses the pseudonym Christopher Luxembourg for his own protection argues that Huri is probably a reference to the Aramaic word for white grapes. That would be plausible, because the Quran compares the Huri to pearls and crystal, and because accounts of heaven from the time of the Quran often included bounteous fruit, especially grapes, to refresh the weary. Would there be as many suicide bombers if the presumption was that the martyrs would arrive at the pearly gates and be handed a dish of white grapes? Westerners sometimes feel sorry for Muslim women in a way that leaves them uncomfortable, even angry. When Nick quizzed a group of female Saudi doctors and nurses in Riyadh about women's rights, they bristled. "Why do foreigners always ask about clothing?" one woman doctor asked. "Why does it matter so much what we wear? Of all the issues in the world, is that really so important?" Another said, "You think we're victims because we cover our hair and wear modest clothing. But we think that it's Western women who are repressed because they have to show their bodies, even go through surgery to change their bodies to please men." A third doctor saw that Nick was taken aback at the scolding, and she tried to explain the indignation. "Look, when we're among ourselves, of course we complain about the rules," she said. "It's ridiculous that we can't drive. But these are our problems, not yours. We don't want anybody fighting for us, and we certainly don't want anybody feeling sorry for us." Americans not only come across as patronizing, but also often miss the complexity of gender roles in the Islamic world. "I'm a Nobel Peace Prize winner and a university professor, but if I testify in a court, it won't take my testimony because I'm a woman," notes Shirin Abadhi, an Iranian lawyer. Any uneducated man would be taken more seriously. Iran is a bundle of contradictions. Women can't testify fully in court, and yet women can be judges presiding over the court. We do have women judges. Any woman who wants to travel abroad needs the consent of her husband, but our vice president is a woman. So when our vice president travels abroad, she needs the consent of her husband. Meanwhile, 65% of Iranian university students are women because they do better on entrance exams than men do. Across the Middle East, attitudes are changing, partly because of the leadership of prominent women such as Queen Rania of Jordan and Sheikh Mazah, the First Lady of Qatar, acceptance of women's rights is spreading. A UN survey in Egypt, Jordan, Lebanon, and Morocco found that more than 98% of people in each country believed that girls have the same right to education as boys. Jordan, Qatar, and Morocco have been among the leaders in giving women greater roles. In Morocco, King Mohammed VI married a computer engineer who does not veil herself and who has become a role model for many Moroccan women. King Mohammed also reformed family law, giving women more rights in divorce and marriage, and he supported the path-breaking appointment of 50 women imams, or preachers. One of the promising efforts to stimulate change in the Arab world is led by Soraya Salti, a 37-year-old Jordanian woman who is promoting entrepreneurship in middle schools and high schools. Soraya's program, Injaz, teaches kids how to devise a business plan and then start and operate a small business. Many of them end up actually starting businesses, and the skills are especially useful for girls because of the discrimination that women face in the formal job market. By giving women an alternative way to pursue careers and earn incomes as entrepreneurs, Injaz also facilitates the expansion of the labor force and economic development as a whole. Queen Rania has strongly backed Soraya, and the program has earned rave reviews. Injaz has now spread to 12 Arab countries and teaches 100,000 students a year how to launch businesses. If you can capture the youth and change the way they think, then you can change the future, Soraya says. A window into the squandered human resources in conservative Muslim societies is the Women's Detention Center in Kabul, Afghanistan. The jail is a single-story compound behind a high wall in the heart of the city, without guard towers or coils of barbed wire. Its inmates include teenage girls and young women who were suspected of having a boyfriend and then subjected to a virginity test, a hymen inspection. Those whose hymens were in disrepair were then prosecuted and typically jailed for a few years. Rana, the middle-aged woman who serves as director of the detention center, is in some ways a pioneer for working women, having risen through the police ranks to direct the jail. but she believes that girls who lack a hymen should be prosecuted, if only to protect them from their families. Every year, Afghanistan's president pardons some inmates during the Eid al-Fitr festival that ends Ramadan. When women are freed, some of them are shot by relatives, or worse, accidentally scalded to death with boiling water. Jail is sometimes the safest place for a bold Afghan woman. One inmate, Elaha, a 19-year-old with short black hair and a round, self-confident face, startled us by greeting us in English and approaching us. She sat down in the dingy little jail room and unselfconsciously spoke of graduating from high school and attending 1 year of university while her family lived as refugees in Iran. Elaha is charming, disciplined, and ambitious. In another culture, she would be an entrepreneur. Her problems began when the family returned to Afghanistan from Iran. Elaha chafed at the more rigid Afghan customs, from the burqa to the expectation that a woman will stay home all her life. "My family wanted to force me to marry my cousin," she said. "I didn't agree to marry him because he is not educated and I don't like his job. He is a butcher. Plus, he's 3 years younger than me. I wanted to study and continue my education, but my father and uncle wouldn't let me." Elaha found work with an American construction company and quickly impressed the managers with her intelligence and diligence. Her family was torn between horror at their daughter working with infidels and delight at the money she brought home. Then one of her bosses, an American named Steve, arranged for Elaha to study at a university in Canada on a full scholarship. Elaha saw this as an opportunity that could transform her life, and she leaped at it, even though her parents worried that it would be un-Islamic for a woman to travel so far away and study with men. The family also still wanted Elaha to marry her cousin, partly because he was the son of her father's oldest brother, the family patriarch. Elaha's sister, 2 years younger, was meant to marry the cousin's younger brother, but the sister followed Elaha's example and resisted. So the family struck back. "When it was almost time for me to go to Canada and I was asking about flights, they tied me up and locked me in a room," Elaha said. "It was in my uncle's house. My father said, 'Okay, beat her.' I'd never been beaten like that in all my life. My uncle and cousins were all beating me. They broke my head, and I was bleeding." Elaha's sister endured the same treatment. After a week of daily beatings as they lay with their wrists and ankles chained, Elaha and her sister agreed to marry the cousins. "My mother guaranteed that we would not escape, and our family took us back to our home after we promised we would be obedient," Elaha said. The family allowed Elaha to resume her job, but her boss rescinded his offer of foreign study when he realized her family adamantly opposed the plan. Elaha was heartbroken but continued to work hard. To help her do her work, she was given a mobile phone. Her family was aghast that she could now communicate unsupervised with men. The family demanded that she give up her phone. "Then our father decided that we must marry. My mother came and said, 'I have no power to help.' So we escaped." Elaha and her sister fled to a cheap guest house, planning to go to Iran and stay with relatives while attending university there. But someone spotted Elaha at the guest house and told her parents, so the police came to arrest her and her sister as runaways. The police subjected them to virginity checks, but their hymens were intact. "They were jailed because their lives were in danger," explained Rana. "To protect her from the anger of her father, she's here." Elaha acknowledged that that was a legitimate concern. "They were very angry," she said of her father and uncle. "I was scared that they might kill me." Elaha's father, a carpenter named Sayyid Jamil, was indignant when we tracked him down in Kabul. "He didn't want us inside his house, so we spoke on the street. We asked him to promise not to harm Elaha, and he did so, but he also vowed that he would no longer allow her to be so free." We don't blame Elaha's difficulties on the Prophet Muhammad or on Islam as such. Islam itself is not misogynistic. But as many Muslims have themselves pointed out, as long as smart, bold women like Elaha disproportionately end up in prison, or in coffins, in some Muslim nations, then those countries are undermining their own hopes for development. There are many reasons for the boom in Muslim terrorists in recent decades, including frustration at backwardness in the Islamic world, as well as resentment of corrupt rulers. But another reason may be the youth bulge in Islam, due partly to lagging efforts on family planning and the broader marginalization of women. A society that has more men than women, particularly young men, is often associated with crime or violence. The historian David Courtwright has argued that one reason America is relatively violent compared to Europe is the legacy of a male surplus. Until World War II, the United States was disproportionately male, and the frontier was overwhelmingly so. The result, he suggests, was a tradition of aggressiveness, short tempers, and violence that still echoes in America's relatively high homicide rates. The same analysis, while controversial, may also help explain why male-dominated Muslim societies have similar threads emphasizing self-reliance, honor, courage, and a quick resort to violence. All this is compounded when the men are young. In Western countries, the cohort aged 15 through 24 makes up an average of 15% of the adult population. In contrast, in many Muslim countries, this share has been more than 30%. For each percentage point increase of youth in the adult population, says Norwegian researcher Henrik Erdal, the risk of conflict increases by more than 4%. Youth bulges may well be particularly destabilizing in conservative Muslim countries because women are largely passive and silent, amplifying the impact of young men. Moreover, in other parts of the world, young men aged 15 through 24 spend many of their waking moments chasing young women. In contrast, in conservative Muslim countries, some young men make war, not love. In strict Muslim countries such as Afghanistan, many young men have little hope of ever finding a partner. Typically, in such nations, there are at least 3% more males than females, partly because females don't receive the same medical care as males. Also, polygamy means that the wealthiest men take two or three wives, leaving even fewer women available for the poor. The inability of a young man to settle down in a family may increase the likelihood of his drifting toward violence. Young men in such countries grow up in an all-male environment, in a testosterone-saturated world that has the ethos of a high school boy's locker room. Organizations made up disproportionately of young men, whether they be gangs or boys' schools or prisons or military units, are often particularly violent. We suspect that the same can be true of entire countries. Countries that repress women also tend to be backward economically, adding to the frustrations that nurture terrorism. Far-sighted Muslim leaders worry that gender inequality blocks them from tapping their nation's greatest unexploited economic resource, the half of the population that is female. In Yemen, women make up only 6% of the non-agricultural labor force. The figure is 9% in Pakistan. Contrast that with between 40% and 50% in countries such as China and the United States. As a UN Arab Human Development Report put it, the rise of women is, in fact, a prerequisite for an Arab Renaissance. Bill Gates recalls once being invited to speak in Saudi Arabia and finding himself facing a segregated audience. 4/5 of the listeners were men on the left. The remaining 1/5 were women, all covered in black cloaks and veils on the right. A partition separated the two groups. Toward the end, during the question and answer session, a member of the audience noted that Saudi Arabia aimed to be one of the top 10 countries in the world in technology by 2010 and asked if that was realistic. Well, if you're not fully utilizing half the talent in the country, said Gates, you're not going to get too close to the top 10. The small group on the right erupted in wild cheering, while the larger audience on the left applauded tepidly. Some evidence suggests that where families repress women, governments end up repressing all citizens. The status of women, more than other factors that predominate in Western thinking about religious systems and politics, links Islam and the democracy deficit, writes the scholar M. Stephen Fish. That may be because an authoritarian and patriarchal home environment is mirrored in an authoritarian and patriarchal political system. The consequences of repressing women may run even deeper. David Landis, the eminent Harvard historian, in his magisterial book, The Wealth and Poverty of Nations, explores why it was Europe that nurtured an industrial revolution and not Asia or the Middle East. He argues that one of the key forces working in Europe's favor was openness to new ideas, and that one of the best gauges of that openness was how a country treated its women. The economic implications of gender discrimination are most serious. To deny women is to deprive a country of labor and talent, but even worse, to undermine the drive to achievement of boys and men. One cannot rear young people in such wise that half of them think themselves superior by biology without dulling ambition and devaluing accomplishment. One cannot call male children pasha or, as in Iran, tell them that they have a golden penis without reducing their need to learn and do. In general, the best clue to a nation's growth and development potential is the status and role of women. This is the greatest handicap of Muslim Middle Eastern societies today, the flaw that most bars them from modernity. The Afghan insurgent. The best-known aid effort in Afghanistan and Pakistan is the school-building project of Greg Mortensen, a mountain climber who came down half-dead from a failed attempt to climb the second-highest peak in the world, K2. Himalayan villagers revived Greg and shared what little they had with him. When he recovered, he found that the village had 78 boys and 4 girls studying school books out in the open, with no school and no teacher, and he promised to return and build them a school. Greg sent out 580 letters appealing for funds and got one check from Tom Brokaw. Eventually, he found other donors and sold his car, his books, and even his beloved climbing gear to raise the money. Ever since, Greg has been building schools throughout the region, following the lead of local people in each instance. Greg became famous as the school builder of Pakistan and then Afghanistan, always working in remote areas and always focusing on girls' schools. You educate a boy and you're educating an individual, Greg says, quoting an African proverb. You educate a girl and you're educating an entire village. More recently, Greg has been training graduates in maternal health care and adding a medical component to his programs. Greg wrote about his work in his powerful book, Three Cups of Tea. And it's the kind of grassroots rural program with local buy-in that has often been most successful in the developing world. Alas, it's also atypical, and Western aid efforts have been particularly ineffective in Muslim countries like Afghanistan and Pakistan. After the American-backed victory over the Taliban in Afghanistan at the end of 2001, well-meaning aid groups dispatched hardy young Americans to Kabul. They rented homes and offices, sending Kabul real estate prices through the roof, and bought fleets of white SUVs. Kabul nightlife boomed, restaurants and DVD shops sprouted, and Kellogg's cornflakes appeared in grocery stores. On a weekend evening in Kabul, you could drop by a restaurant catering to aid workers and see $1 million worth of SUVs parked out front. The flood of aid programs targeted Afghan women, and they did some good, but typically they didn't reach far into the countryside, where they were most needed. Moreover, many Afghans felt threatened by Christians or Jews entering their country, walking around naked by Afghan standards, and urging women, learn to read, get a job, empower yourself, throw off your burqa. One aid group, innocently trying to gather names of local people for a database, asked for the names not only of men in each household, but also of women and girls. That was perceived as scandalously intrusive. Another Western aid group, trying to improve the hygiene and health of Afghan women, issued them bars of soap, nearly causing a riot. In Afghanistan, washing with soap is often associated with post-coital activity, so the group was thought to be implying that the women were promiscuous. At the other extreme of effectiveness is Sakina Yaqubi, a force of nature who runs an aid organization called the Afghan Institute of Learning. Short and stout, her hair bundled in a scarf, waving greetings to one person while bantering in rapid-fire English with another, Sakina is perpetually in motion. Perhaps the reason fundamentalists haven't silenced her yet is that she herself is an Afghan Muslim, less threatening than an outsider. American organizations would have accomplished much more if they had financed and supported Sakina rather than dispatching their own representatives to Kabul. That's generally true. The best role for Americans who want to help Muslim women isn't holding the microphone at the front of the rally, but writing the checks and carrying the bags in the back. Sakina grew up in Herat, in northwestern Afghanistan, and although she was accepted by Kabul University, she couldn't attend because of the violence at the time, so she traveled halfway around the world to Stockton, California, attending the University of the Pacific on a scholarship as a pre-med student. Afterward, she studied public health at Loma Linda University, while bringing 13 members of her family to safety in the United States. But Sakina wanted to help her people, and so she moved to Pakistan to work in the Afghan refugee camps, where she tried to provide health care and education. She began by opening a girls' school in Peshawar with 300 pupils. A year later, she had 15,000 students. The Taliban barred girls from getting an education in Afghanistan, but Sakina nonetheless opened a string of secret schools for girls there. "It wasn't easy, and it was very risky," she recalls. "I negotiated that if people supplied houses and protected the schools and the students, then we would pay the teachers and provide supplies. So we had 3,800 students in underground schools. We had rules that the students would arrive at intervals, no men were allowed inside, and people would work as lookouts." The operation was immensely successful, protecting 80 secret schools and suffering only one Taliban raid. "That was my fault," Sakina admits. "I allowed an English woman to visit, and the children talked, and the Taliban raided the next day. But we had advance warning, and so the teacher dispersed the children and turned the classroom into a regular room of the house. It was okay in the end." Sakina's operation for Afghan refugees in Pakistan was even larger and included a university for women, as well as literacy classes for adults. Once the Taliban fell, Sakina moved her Afghan Institute of Learning back to Kabul, and she now provides education and other services for 350,000 women and children in Afghanistan. The institute has 480 staff members, 80% of them women, and it operates in 7 provinces. Many of the women students at Kabul University are graduates of her programs. The institute runs a teacher training program as well as workshops that focus on teaching women their legal rights, both in civil law and Islamic law. That's a sensitive issue, of course, but it is more palatable to the clerics when it comes from a Muslim woman in a headscarf than from American infidels. "Education is the key issue for overcoming poverty, for overcoming war," Sakina says. "If people are educated, then women will not be abused or tortured. They will also stand up and say, 'My child should not be married so young.'" The institute teaches religion as well, but in a way that might horrify fundamentalists. Moderate passages from the Quran are taught, so that women can direct their husbands to passages that call for respect for women. Often it is the first time that either women or men have realized that there are such verses in the Quran. Sakina runs an archipelago of fixed and mobile health clinics, which offer Afghans family planning services and free condoms. Another fundamental part of her work involves economic empowerment measures. "When people have empty stomachs, they can't learn," she says. So the institute offers classes in a range of skills that enable women to earn an income. These include sewing, embroidery, hairstyling, and computer science. Young women who can master computer skills can get jobs as soon as they graduate for $250 per month, several times what most young men earn. Sakina has now been widely recognized for her work, and UNFPA and other groups channel assistance through her. Bill Drayton's team selected Sakina to be the first Ashoka Fellow from Afghanistan. She is indeed one of that country's great social entrepreneurs, a perfect model for Alaha, the young Afghan woman in jail, if she isn't murdered by her father, and constantly in danger. She shrugs it off. "Every day there is a death threat," she laughs. "I'm always changing cars."